Well, welcome everyone. First of all, I'd like to thank the students who guided you around the building, and I hope you enjoyed it. There's been a little bit of evolution in this building, because I know some of you have mentioned to me before that you were here 40, 45 years ago, and the labs are somewhat revamped from that time, but of course we're not finished with the $45 million or so renovations. We've given Dean Grant the night off, so it's my pleasure to serve as your host here tonight. And as tradition dictates, we go over whatever happened last time. So I trust that you did do your homework, you smoked pot, and you're ready to report on the effects. Well, the question, based on what you would have learned last time, is it true that smoking marijuana destroys brain cells? Seems to be a universal answer, based upon hearsay, anecdote, and some personal evidence, I would think. This is indeed the correct answer, but maybe I will read you what Dr. Ware actually said on this so that we can get all of the details. No, cannabinoids do not destroy brain cells. They can change the way brain cells connect to each other. This is important during fetal and childhood development. Having exposure to cannabinoids at the wrong time can rewire the brain. The brain is a plastic structure. We don't know enough to suggest cannabinoids cause cell death, but they may change the brain's architecture. This hasn't been studied for very long, but right now we know that controlled amounts can be used for a long time without harm. So there's the detailed answer to that. And as I'm sure you remember from last time, there are numerous medical uses now that are being explored for marijuana. Today, a switch in direction. We're going to take a look at the pain-reward connection. And I wanted to give a brief introduction to what this would be, but our speaker, Dr. Petra Schweinhardt, is going to do it much better because she told me that she has actually designed it so that you will learn from the beginning why the talk is entitled The Pain-Reward Connection. Dr. Schweinhardt got her medical degree in Germany, from where she went to Sweden at the Karolinska Institute, pretty prestigious place. And then she did a PhD at Oxford University in England. Oxford, as you know, is the McGill of England. And and then she came to North America, came to McGill as a postdoctoral fellow, and now has a staff position here at McGill. And her workplace is just up the street here in the Strathcona building. And her background is in brain imaging. That's what she did her PhD in, and I suspect we're going to hear quite a bit about that here tonight. So I'm anxious to hear about the pain-reward connection, and I suspect that just in the first few minutes of this talk, we're going to learn exactly what that terminology means. So please welcome Dr. Schweinhardt.
Good evening, everybody, and thank you very much for this kind introduction. You can relax now. It's your last lecture. There will be no quizzes next time. So the fun starts now. I understand that this is your seventh lecture, so by now I'm sure that you're all experts on pain, actually, and today we will be infusing some reward. And as Joel said already, we will go through this in quite some detail, but I try to keep it light, considering it's Wednesday night. I saw the reading you have done. I'm impressed, I have to admit. If especially the second article was an easy read for you, I ask you to come to my lab tomorrow and start working with me. That would be impressive. So, the talk is entitled Pain-Reward Connection. Those two things seem pretty distinct at first sight. I would think pain and reward are not really the same thing. So why might there be a link between those two, or why am I saying that, or how might they actually be connected? And this is what we are going to be looking at in this talk. Not much brain imaging, I'm sorry. So for them to be a connection, you would think they should occur simultaneously, right? And this is, I would like to illustrate this with this slide here, which I hope you can see. I will read it to you anyway. So this lady, it seems to be a very cold winter, not like the last one we had, around minus 30 degrees. And this lady said, "We must do something about these poor people outside in this extreme cold weather." And then the man says, "The homeless? No, the smokers." So how come that these people, the smokers, endure this freezing cold, which can be really painful, as you know, and still go out to get their smoke? There are smoking mittens that might that might help a little bit, but still, minus 30 is a lot, as we know. So glass that go up, protect up to minus 30, I'm not convinced that this really helps all the way. So what is it about pain and reward then? So what these two things, I started out saying they're very distinct, as I'm sure, I hope everybody is just going to believe me without me providing evidence to you. But what do these two things have in common, actually? And what they have in common is that they're two fundamental things that motivate us in life, right? They are really important for survival. It is either that we are trying to avoid pain, like this poor chap here in on the left, who actually didn't, unfortunately, manage to avoid pain, but hopefully he's learned enough so that next time he doesn't put his hand on the hot stove. Or actually, the reward on the other side is a very important motivation in life. Then you might think, okay, I've put the smoker up here, but how does that fit together? Smoking surely is not good for survival, right, as we all know. The reason, and that is something I do not know whether you've heard about this or not, is that what smoking actually does, and many or probably all drugs of abuse, is to hijack a brain system that is there to promote behavior that enhance survival. And the primary ones are food, drinking, water, and sex. So promote survival either of oneself or of the species. So this is what our reward system in the brain is there for, to drive us to do these things and to seek out these things. Fortunately, unfortunately, fortunately for our pleasure experience, unfortunately for addictions, etc., these synthetic drugs hijack the system, and this is why actually they are so rewarding but also addictive. So those two things often are in competition. They are pain and reward, they are, as I said, the very strong motivators for us in life. And I would like to illustrate that to you by this cave I've put here. So if you think you or one of your ancestors is sitting in this cave, and outside is, so up there, outside is some food source. You would really like to get to that food source, but you also know there's some sort of wild animal around, which might actually, if not eat you completely up, at least hurt you. So you have this decision to make whether you will actually go out and go for this food reward, right? For to try to get the food in order not to starve. On the other hand, you neither want to be killed by that animal and you neither want to feel pain. So the decision of whether you will actually go out there and take the risk of potentially getting the reward or not will also depend a lot on your current state, right? If you're very satisfied and you've just eaten and you still have the fridge in your cave full of chocolate pie, the incentive to go out is obviously much smaller than if you are really already hungry and you know there's nothing around and you have a small kid at home to feed. So that hopefully already illustrates you a little bit that there's this close interaction, or there must be this close interaction between those two systems. And in the context of pain, that actually has been formalized or described by Howard Fields, of whom you've also had an article to read, in what he called the motivation decision model. So this is basically just what I said. It conceptualizes the idea that the organism, the animal, the human needs to get to a reward, but in the presence of pain, it has to make a decision whether it will actually still go for the reward and endure the pain, or whether the pain is maybe too threatening and the reward is not important enough so that the reward will not be obtained or will not be sought after, and the pain is going to be avoided. And this is very nicely described by Howard Fields already. And it has been mentioned also in the other article that you read. And what my lab is basically doing is actually testing a couple of the hypotheses that are coming out of that model, because a lot of it is a conceptual theoretical framework. So we've set out to test a couple of the implications of this model. So what is one of the implications? So wouldn't it be useful if the organism, me for example, then decides to go for the reward if the pain was actually suppressed by my body, right? Because if I now actually have decided that I would go for the reward, I do not want to feel all that pain, right? I might as well have a system in place that's going to suppress it. So that would be the idea that anything that is rewarding should actually suppress or inhibit pain. And this is something we set out to test in the laboratory, not with this young lady, or we took a slightly different approach. Here you see an illustration sort of an example we might be familiar with, an extreme athlete that actually keeps going despite of pain. But we actually wanted to test that in the laboratory, whether we can actually show this. And what we did, we took something, a rewarding stimulus that in our society has very consistent qualities of reward, and that is money. Money itself doesn't, it only activates this reward system, or it hijacks it because it stands for something else, right? Because you can then go out and buy things you really want to have with that money. So, but it's a very universal currency, so this is why we used it. With food and things, you would have the issue that maybe you like chocolate cookies, but you don't, and you like cars, and you don't, or you think of the environmental impact, etc. So money is relatively universal being associated with reward. So what we had people doing, they came to our lab, and they were playing a task, a so-called Wheel of Fortune task. So you see the wheel here in front of you, and it had a purple, a blue, and a white section, all of equal size. And you, imagine you are the subject, you have the choice of either pressing the purple button or the blue button. Then the wheel starts spinning, I still want to be friends with the technicians, so I didn't put a video, but I have arrows indicating that the wheel was spinning. And if then the wheel landed on the color you chose, you won a certain amount of money. If it landed on the color you did not choose, you lost money. And if it just landed on white, you neither won nor lost. And that was indicated to the subjects before, so they knew. What happened simultaneously to test actually our prediction that reward would be inhibiting the pain is that once in a while, not always, not in all trials, you were really into that game, you were really playing it, and this is it, indeed what we saw what subjects did, so those $3 mattered to them. We would zap them with a thermo that we attached to their hand. Those are stimuli we use a lot. They are painful. They're intended to be painful. They're not causing tissue damage. We wouldn't be allowed by the ethical committees to do so. But they're causing relatively, let's say moderate pain. We also have stimuli that are actually not painful, just sort of warm as controlled stimuli. And then, that might be a bit too small for you to see, but I will describe it to you. After they had seen the outcome, and they had received the thermal stimulation, they rated how painful it was on a scale. I think you've actually seen that before in one of the lectures. So how painful it was and how unpleasant they found the stimulus. And what we see, and we've seen this very consistently now, is that whereas with this just warm stimulus, which you see here, in the neutral condition, in the winning condition, and in the losing condition, not much happens. But then with the painful stimulus, this is here, you see the neutral condition. When subjects are winning money and getting the same type of stimulation, it's exactly the same temperature, same everything, they're rating it as being less painful. And if they actually have just lost money, then they're actually rating it as being more painful. So that seems to be correct about this motivation decision model, that something that is rewarding, such as money, even in a laboratory setting, can actually influence your pain perception. The question is, how is that actually achieved? So how does our body do that? And I've put the brain here because, as I sort of said before when I told you about these systems that are hijacked by substances of abuse, that those are brain systems. So reward is processed in the brain. I hope that makes sense to everybody without me explaining that further. It's nothing that is processed in our muscles, toes, or somewhere else. Pain is different. Pain has a peripheral component here throughout the body, but also in our brains. But since we are talking about this connection between the two, the brain is the place where this interaction must be happening, actually. And before I come back to pain, I just want to make the case to you that the brain, in many, many instances, is a very powerful modulator of incoming signals that we receive constantly from our environment. So that's not something that is specific to pain. And I just want to show you this example. You're looking at it, and you might be thinking, why on earth is she showing that to us, those spirals here? So are you seeing spirals? Yeah. It's circles, actually. And I know it is hard to believe, and I'm not tricking you. We can try. If I try to keep this mouse here on this thing, right, so if I follow, and if it was a circle, as I'm claiming, we should come back to the same point, right? And what is happening, it is indeed a circle, right? And your brain tells you it's a spiral, but no, it's a circle. So with many of these examples where our brain actually is not a faithful or doesn't provide us with a faithful representation of our environment, but does something to that signal that we receive. Just want to show you another example. What are you seeing here? I have to guess. I have no idea what you're saying. Oh, one wants to speak up, maybe. Thank you for this very clear answer. So, right. So he called it sex. Other people might be saying a naked man and a naked woman. But we see these bodies, right? I can tell you that small kids, including mine, see dolphins. And you think, why on earth do they see dolphins, right? What are their brains making out? If you actually, you can do it too. If you look carefully, you will see dolphins, right? The sensory input is identical. It's only our brain. For what reason? I leave that here. I'm not going to touch that topic tonight. But for some reason, small kids see dolphins and we see sex. Right. So that's an illustration of our brain constantly interpreting incoming signals. So if somebody tells you, I see this, we're not really in a position to say, no, you don't, right? Because we know that we cannot really rely on our input neither. Same is true for pain. And how is that achieved? That is achieved, and I think you've seen something very similar, so I will not dwell on this. But we have a very important so-called ascending system, meaning going up from the level of the spinal cord, where pain signals come in, that are transmitted to the brain. So far, so good. If that was the only thing that was happening, your pain might be similar to my pain. But then we have this whole system in the brain that actually sends down descending pathways to the same entry site and modulates, either enhances or blocks the pain signals that are coming in from the periphery. Right? So this is this pain modulation system we are having that is exceedingly powerful, as has been shown in many instances in the past years, and that is probably one of the important reasons why your pain is not my pain. And what is interesting about this system, that an important transmitter, so one of the important chemicals in this system, are opioids. You see them here, so that's the level of the brainstem, which is about, I'm not sure how much I'm allowed to point, but at this level here, and then also then further down and at the level of the spinal cord, you still have them. So, and that is a relatively well-established system. Yet, I have to tell you, and that's something we are working on, we do not know whether this pain reduction by reward is really mediated via this system. So this is something we are currently testing with brain imaging, but at this point I cannot tell you yet. What is interesting and what makes me think that there might be something else going on is that opioids are also, so these endogenous opioids, these very important pain modulators, right? I mean, opioids is a substance like morphine, right? Morphine is has so much pain relieving properties because it acts on the same receptors as our opioids do that are released by our own bodies, right? So, but these opioids are not only released, you know, in this descending pathway that I just showed to you, they're also released much higher up in the brain in several areas. We're not going to discuss these areas now. I think that's boring. But in many, many different areas, in response to reward, that makes sense. We think we feel reward in the brain and not somewhere in the spinal cord, but also in response to pain. So this is an example I'm showing to you here from a pain study, actually. That is the opioid response in the brain in response to a painful stimulation. So this makes me think that this reward-pain interaction and this pain inhibition by reward might actually be potentially mediated higher up than other pain modulation effects. But that's an idea at this point. Maybe if we do something like this again in the future, I can give you an update on that. I would like to touch upon another very important molecule in the context of reward processing and maybe also in the context of pain processing, and that is dopamine. I don't know whether you've heard about dopamine, but dopamine has been for years now really the favorite molecules of anybody researching reward. Why is that? Because it's a very important chemical in the brain system that we know is associated with reward processing. Again, we will not talk in detail about these brain areas. If you want to know things, ask me afterwards, but I think that would be a little bit too much detail. So it's a very important molecule for reward processing. For pain processing, I think we've sort of neglected it. There are a couple of reports suggesting something, but nobody has really systematically looked at the role of dopamine in pain. And to be honest, not only not systematically looked at it, but also the ideas that are out there are probably wrong, and we're just getting some better data that actually might explain findings much better than, you know, we've used to. And the role, I've been saying that dopamine has been very well studied for reward processing, and the key role it has really been found to play is motivational drive or wanting something. Not so much getting pleasure out of something, because there are those two sides to reward, right? But really wanting something. And that actually can be differentiated, even if that's difficult. So somebody has now seen actually the picture. That's fantastic. So this mouse wanted to get to this cheese, right? And it didn't care where the maze actually went and which way it was supposed to take. It just went the direct route. So that mouse was clearly motivated to get to this cheese, right? And dopamine has a very important part to play in this behavior. So we actually wanted to know, based on the prominent role dopamine has in reward processing and the limited knowledge we have about pain processing and dopamine, we actually wanted to know what happens to this reward-pain interaction when we interfere with the dopaminergic system in the brain. And this is a very similar graph to what you saw before and is the same task, so it's comforting for us that it looks similar. And this is just without any interference with the dopaminergic system. So that's just our placebo condition. So we give an inert substance as a control condition and a certain pain rating in the neutral condition. You see the pain rating goes down even here below the pain threshold, so people even don't find the stimulus any longer painful in the winning condition. And when they lose money, it's the same task as before. They find it more painful, as you've seen before. So what happens now if we give a substance, in this instance, sulfuride, that's a little detail, that interferes with this transmission of the dopaminergic signal in the brain? So what you see here is that both effects are enhanced. So first of all, in the neutral condition, not much happens, speaking in favor of the idea that dopamine doesn't have much to do with baseline pain sensitivity. But see then what happens in the winning condition. So this pain relief by reward is enhanced, right? But this pain increase by punishment, by losing, is also enhanced. So how could we actually interpret that? What might that actually mean? So the way we've interpreted it, I will mention to you in a second. I just sort of want to summarize the motivation decision model, or what we've found so far as evidence for this model for you. So when the organism actually receives reward, so you could say decides in favor of reward, pain is decreased. Makes a lot of sense. When the organism actually receives punishment rather than reward, pain is even enhanced. Now the question is, why? What might be the ecological value of that? Why on earth should that be happening? And again, that's something that hasn't been tested, but the idea would be, and the idea that we are pursuing is that maybe, so if the organism is in the situation, it's receiving pain and in addition some sort of punishment, there is no reason whatsoever to stay in this painful situation, right? So why does the body not enhance the pain perception, increase the pain perception to make it even more likely to escape, for the organism to escape or to avoid the pain? So to increase the motivation to actually escape the pain if possible. So that's the working hypothesis we are having. And then from the last data I showed you, it seems that dopamine is a very important molecule to push the organism towards a decision, right? Decision here, we are not talking about a conscious decision, right? But if I'm in a rewarding situation and I want to dampen my pain, it seems that dopamine helps me to dampen the pain even further. Whereas I am in a punishing condition and my pain is already enhanced, dopamine seems to help me, in quotes, to even enhance the pain further, to increase my motivation to get away from this painful stimulation. So far, what I've been telling you was really what happens to pain when in the presence of a rewarding or also a punishing stimulus. But we haven't really looked at the other side of the coin, right? We haven't looked what happens to reward processing when there's pain. And this is what we are going to do in the second part now. Before we can talk about this, I want to introduce to you that reward is a really really complex construct, and there are several components that can actually be dissociated, and I just want to mention the three most important ones here. One is pleasure. I already mentioned that, the pleasure of a rewarding stimulus, right? The pleasure of eating this chocolate cake, if there wasn't that bad conscience that one shouldn't, but apart from that, it's pleasurable. There is the motivation. We talked about this with the little mouse and dopamine. The motivation to obtain a reward. So in the animal literature, pleasure and motivation has been termed liking and wanting, but they're very related concepts. And then there's also a component of risk-taking. And as I hopefully illustrated to you with the example of the cave, us sitting in the cave, there's often a component of risk-taking involved in order to decide to go for a reward or not. So what we decided to do was to study the influence of pain on motivation and pleasure. How did we do this? Again, we invited subjects to our laboratory and had them play a game. This is basically what we do all day in our lab, so if you're interested, you might. So they were sitting in front of a computer screen and saw a certain amount of money as an incentive. In this case, $4. And they were instructed that as soon as a certain target cue, a star, would appear, they have to press a mouse button as fast as they can in order to actually receive that reward. If not, they wouldn't receive it. So now the target cue comes up and you press as quickly as you can with your left index finger. Fast enough? Hopefully. Because if you were, you would have won the $4. If you weren't fast enough, you wouldn't lose, at least, but you didn't win the money. So in this construct, the time it takes you to press the mouse button is an index of your motivation, or how much you actually want this reward. If somebody doesn't care, they're not going to press terribly fast. If you think of $4, you know, what are $4? So for me, it's not. Or a person thinks, oh, I really would like to have these $4, you know, that is going to influence how fast they press the button. I should mention, or maybe I shouldn't, but I will mention to you in this context that in these types of study, we often investigate young, poor, McGill students. They're pretty motivated to press the button. And then afterwards, after they pressed the button, either fast enough or not, they actually then had to tell us by a rating scale how much they liked or disliked the outcome. So if they just had just seen the $4 and so they just had the feedback they were fast enough, they received the $4, they would probably rate somewhere on the right side of the scale that they liked it. And if they just lost some money, they didn't lose the money, but if they didn't win the money, they probably wouldn't like that outcome so much. So that was the idea behind that. So what, and in addition, they were not playing this task only once. You also have to imagine they play it over and over again. It's not just one trial. So one of the things I just presented to you, or you also see here, is a trial, and we play these things over and over and over again with them, with different incentives, different amounts of dollars they can win, etc. And in one condition, meaning one session on one day, they received pain while doing this task. And the way we did it, we used the active ingredient of hot chili peppers, capsaicin, which you can rub on the skin. I know it sounds cool. It's not bad. It's actually sold in pharmacies, so it's ethical to do. I hope. And we rub it on their skin. We leave it there for 20 minutes. Then we remove the cream, and the skin is sensitized. It is basically like, yeah, I don't know. You can't eat hot food with your skin, but, you know, that is what makes hot chili peppers hot, right? So it is sensitizing the skin. And then we just apply just a warm temperature. It's not a painful temperature, it's just a warm. But on the sensitized skin, it's like basically, imagine you're having a sunburn and somebody puts a warm stimulus on you, or you're having a warm shower. Not pleasant, right? That's the same thing. So, and then in the other condition, and that, you know, gives us a nice constant pain experience of the subject. And in the other condition, we do the same thing, but without the capsaicin cream. So they receive the same warm stimulus, but this time it's only warm. It's not painful, so that's our control condition. So then they play the task, and then we see what actually happens to our outcome measures. So what we see, first of all, is this nice modulation of their reaction times. Remember, that's our outcome measure. How fast do they actually press this button? This is what we're interested in. So even McGill students are not terribly thrilled by 4 cents, but they get faster and faster, and by $4 they're pretty fast. And I can tell you, I mean, this is sort of almost the physiological low for reaction times. They cannot be faster than that. But then happens, let's see what happens when they then actually have pain. They even get faster, only for $4. They don't do more work for 4 cents or for $1 when they have pain, but they get faster for $4 when they have pain. So we interpret this as that this pain they're having on their leg actually increases their motivation to obtain the reward, right? They're pressing the button faster. They want this $4 reward more than they wanted it in the other conditions. What is then interesting to see, look at those lines that completely overlap. So the rating of how much they liked the reward was identical, whether they had pain or not. So you see nicely that at least they liked the $4 more than the $1, than the 4 cent. Good, so far so good. But pain just didn't have any influence whatsoever. And what is really interesting about that piece of data is that it very closely mirrors what has been observed with animals. And I show that study to you now. So that's, what is that? That's a bowl of Cheerios. So that's a researcher actually in another lab at McGill, but that was work she did when she was still in London in England. She put, I don't think it was a heart-shaped one. I think it was a round bowl of Cheerios in the middle of a field. And then rats had basically a circle in which they could be moving, which was just over a meter wide. And she also had marked a smaller circle, just something like 30 centimeters diameter in the middle. And as I said, this should just be in the blown-up version. So in the, very in the middle here, there was this bowl of Cheerios. And I'm told, I'm not a red person, but I'm told reds like Cheerios. And what did she say? The honey flavor. I think that was what I was cutting it, the honey flavor. So the honey-flavored Cheerios are in the middle of this field. And just to illustrate the idea behind this test, just see what happens to the time and central zone of the reds. So the central zone is this inner zone when the bowl of Cheerios is present versus when it's absent. So they spend a lot more time in this inner zone when they are Cheerios. So what happens then with pain was the question those researchers were asking. So what is very interesting is that these are the animals with pain and these are the animals without pain. And just see, so the animals with pain spent quite some more time in this inner zone, close to the Cheerios, than the animals not having pain. What is also very interesting about this piece of data is that this is the same whether animals are just receiving pain now. Sort of, it was not in the presence of pain. They had received an incision on their foot, and then it was tested afterwards, or whether it had actually been an incision just after birth that was then repeated later in life. So in both instances, they were more interested in these Cheerios. Their motivation to have Cheerios was increased. They spent more time in the inner zone, and actually, if you're wondering about these other graphs, the number of barriers, how often they go up, is another measure that just behaves the opposite way. And so demonstrated, you know, when the Cheerios are present, they don't rear so much. And then same observation in the animals with pain, they don't rear so much. So both indices indicate that these reds really wanted these Cheerios more. But what was really interesting in analogy to the human data, they didn't eat more. So they spent more time there. They were more motivated to get it, but they just didn't eat more, suggesting that actually they didn't get a lot of pleasure out of eating these Cheerios. Yeah? So you have the same disconnection we've seen in the study I presented from our lab in this red study saying that, okay, you have pain or there is pain and the motivation to obtain reward is increased, but the pleasure one is getting out of it is actually not changed. Which brings me to the potential clinical importance of what I've been talking about. So I maintain, and I hope I have already, and I want to convince you that it is important to understand the reciprocal relationship between pain and reward. And as we've seen with this change in motivational behavior, it seems that pain change, and of course motivation, I don't have to tell you that, is very important in goal-directed behavior. Any behavior that I do in order to obtain a certain goal is going to be driven by my motivation, right? So could it then actually be that the presence of pain, and now we're thinking also chronic pain patients, might have actually alterations in their goal-directed behavior. Maybe they're more motivated, but the other aspect was they're not getting more pleasure out of it. And what is actually what the clinical data is actually suggesting, which I'm sure it comes as no surprise to you, is that patients with a chronic pain condition often suffer from an inability to feel pleasure called anhedonia. So we don't see this with our acute models that actually people then have decreased pleasure, but at least they don't have increased pleasure. So there seems to be this differential influence of pain on these two aspects of reward processing. So this reward processing with pain just seems to be very different to when there's no pain. And all these things, so both an influence on goal-directed behavior, which is very important, you know, to our success in life, as well as the inability to feel pleasure, are obviously two things that are likely to influence, I mean, I'm claiming this here now, but are likely to influence the quality of life of somebody with pain tremendously. That's one aspect, the pain influence on reward processing. But then the other aspect is actually that there's this piece of data I showed you that if there is a punishment and there is then actually this pain facilitation in the absence of reward, it might well be that this pain facilitation, which is brought about by our own bodies, enhances or contributes to the pain a patient is feeling. And that is something that hasn't been studied, but that is obviously something that would also be really important clinically if those pain facilitator systems were switched on in pain patients who often, as you know, cannot avoid their pain, right? That's the problem. I show you all these models, and then the organism would decide to avoid the pain, but a chronic pain patient can't avoid their pain, right? And that might be one of the fundamental issues. Then this pain-enhancing system by the body is switched on, and the pain is further aggravated, etc. So this is really all I wanted to tell you. I'm more than happy to take your questions now, and I'm looking forward to our discussion.
Thanks very much. As you know, the way that we handle the questions is for you to write them down, pass them to the volunteers, and they will bring them down, then we will select some and answer them. The questions that you ask, you should realize, will be on the web for all eternity, so therefore be careful of what you say about masochism and...
What are you thinking, Joe?
Are opioids released higher up in the brain because of increased pain, increased reward, or increased interaction of pain and reward?
This is what I'm working on. It seems very likely that they're released, or we know they're released in response, or when there's a rewarding stimulus. We know that they bring about the sense of pleasure that is associated with the rewarding stimulus. Whether it is then also those opioids in these brain centers that decrease the pain, or whether pain is decreased via more traditional pain inhibiting pathways that descend down to the spinal cord, we do not know at this point. I should also say, different to the dopamine story, opioids are released just in response to pain, so there doesn't have to be any reward, and that itself is sort of, it's like a switch, or it's switching on the endogenous pain inhibiting system of the body, probably to limit the pain one is experiencing, right? And it's also something we find, for example, in people with chronic pain, that they have chronically overactive endogenous opioid systems, which probably eventually leads to sort of some sort of wear out effect that, you know, you have a lot of this opioid soup in the brain, which means that the receptors they bind to, they go inside the cells because it's just too much opioids. And then people seem to become less sensitive to both the opioids released by the body as well as by opioids we in the medical community administer. So there's probably some longer-term shift with chronic pain in the opioid system that makes the opioid system as a pain-relieving system less efficacious.
In experiments where capsaicin was used to sensitize the skin, what were the subjects told that this was for?
That's a very important question because for many of our experiments, it's important that subjects do not know what the goal of the study actually is. What we framed that they knew they would be receiving pain in one condition and not pain in the other, and there would be no way of not telling them because after a few seconds they found out, right? But what they think they're doing, and you could say, in a sense, they are, that they're playing a cognitive decision-making task. This is how we are phrasing it. So they do not know that we are after this rewarding aspect. This is something we try to, you know, hide from them, if you like.
Capsaicin is very interesting in this regard because it's also used to relieve pain.
Right. But only with, and that's why you can actually buy it in the pharmacy. You cannot buy it in the pharmacy to induce pain, I assume. You buy it in the pharmacy to relieve pain. And the mechanism how that works is you have to use it chronically, right? And by using it chronically, it actually depletes your peripheral nerve fibers of the substances that transmit the pain signals from the periphery to the spinal cord. So only with chronic administration you get the pain relieving effect. Interestingly, and it is relatively effective, but quite a few patients don't go through with it because it's so painful to start with.
Do the pain modulation systems change with age?
Excellent question. Have been suggestions in the literature. I don't find those study trustworthy, and hence I would say we do not know. There's loads of stuff to be done in the pain field. You see, I'm just trying to get you in, you know, involved.
That's an interesting one about pain and reward. How can I enjoy the hip pain I have?
Very good. Any suggestions from the audience? A very important point. I think clinically there are probably two things that are mostly important. One is a sort of acceptance, and that's very similar to grieving, right? It's these five stages of grieving you might be familiar with or not. It's at a certain, things we cannot change in life, and that's interesting about pain, whether we can or not, right? But things we cannot change in life, we are much better off accepting them and not wasting energy fighting them. So in many chronic pain situations, when it's really a situation, I do not know about your hip pain, but there are many situations where the patients just know, let's take somebody with rheumatoid arthritis, the pain will be there for the rest of their lives. Once people accept that, that is already sort of a first step, along a positive clinical trajectory. Another very important, and that's where it becomes a bit more cognitive, is accepting this pain, and now we're getting back to goal-directed behavior and goal setting, adjusting goals. So basically seeing what there is rewarding in life I can still do despite having this pain. So if I used to be this mountain climber and I cannot do this despite of my pain anymore, it's very normal to be frustrated and depressed, etc. by that. But that is not going to bring me back to the mountain, right? So I have to find alternatives, and often pain management programs, that's something they mainly work on, is what is it I could take up as a hobby, or maybe there's something I've been thinking about doing it, have not done it, etc. What is it I could be doing as a profession, as a hobby, that still gives me pleasure, is rewarding, but is actually also realistic and feasible with my pain? And that is what often then really changes the life of people with chronic pain in a more positive direction. I don't know for your specific hip pain. Sorry? The gait theory? No. Not really.
When I've experienced severe pain, I find myself craving sweets. Can you comment?
Doesn't that just illustrate what we've been talking about? I mean, that's exactly, that is this interaction, right? So, feeling pain, enhanced motivation to obtain reward. This is exactly what this person, thank you, we might want to include you in our slides, is describing. That's exactly what we find in the laboratory. So that's nice to have a real-life example as well.
Is there any relationship in the broader sense, are groups of people who live in war-torn places affected by their painful lives in terms of seeking rewards? Can they find pleasure under dire circumstances?
I'm not war-torn, like...
I'm not sure. Does whoever asked that question want to elaborate on what... Yeah.
People who are living where there's bombing going on.
Right.
Going on. It's
yeah.
Very painful.
Yeah.
So how can people in circumstances like that get some kind of pleasure in their lives?
I do not know. I could only speculate as much as you do, but it wouldn't be based on anything, so... Because it's a very serious topic, I feel I should not just, saying what I'm thinking or what I might be guessing. Is that okay?
Yeah, this is a good one. Do patients who have problems with their dopamine system, such as Parkinson's, have they been used in your pain research?
Yeah. That's sort of part of this muddy literature I mentioned before. So there are some reports that people with Parkinson's disease might be more sensitive to pain, and people with schizophrenia, which sometimes has been conceptualized to be the other side of the coin to Parkinson. Parkinson, less dopamine, schizophrenia, more dopamine, and then schizophrenic patients have been shown to be less sensitive to pain. So that seemed to fit this idea that dopamine was actually influencing the pain sensitivity. But that data is pretty dirty, to be honest, and what we are finding now, it seems much more that dopamine is not really directly linked to how sensitive somebody to pain is, but what the subject is going to do about the pain, so much more in line with this motivational role in the reward processing literature. And if I can just say one more thing to that, that also fits, or let's put it this way, this idea that has been out there that dopamine influences directly pain sensitivity, or is actually inhibiting pain, doesn't fit at all with some data. Another lab, and we have actually collected this time brain imaging, looking at how much dopamine is released in the brain in response to pain, you find a wonderful relationship between the more painful people find the stimulation, the more dopamine they release, which, if it was really that dopamine would inhibit pain, wouldn't make any sense, right? So I've been seeing this relationship for a few years now, I admit, and couldn't really make sense out of it. And now, with the sort of new thinking about the role of dopamine, it starts to make a lot of sense, because the more pain you have, the more you want to do about this pain, right? So that's the current thinking I'm having, at least.
Is no pain not enough of a reward in your experiments?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question, and that's something else we are working on, is where the question whether pain relief itself is a reward, and it very much looks like. I mean, it's a different type of reward, something we call intrinsic, because it's intrinsic to the pain system, whereas money obviously is a very extrinsic reward. But fundamentally, yeah, it seems that pain relief itself has many of the rewarding properties as any other type of reward. Yeah.
Are there any more? Maybe I can ask one. There's some religions in which self-flagellation plays a big part. Mm-hmm. Does that relate to any of your research? I mean, is the religious satisfaction that they get out of that, is that the reward?
I would think so, but of course, I think at the same time one could be asking the question, is the pain necessary in order to get this religious satisfaction? And if you look at, I mean, you don't have to go so extreme. I think even in Christianity there's this idea that, you know, one will be punished, or at least judged and potentially punished. So, I mean, religions often play with this two-sided coin of pain and reward, of suffering, of punishment and reward. I don't know it. To be honest, again, it would just be speculation. But it seems to me, I mean, it's just another illustration how closely connected those two motivational systems are.
Okay, well, we'd like to thank Dr. Schweinhardt very much for this, and we do have the traditional McGill gift for you, and it probably is going to come in handy.
That's fantastic. For my vodka, you were saying?
Yeah. As you know, the questions that you've asked are on the website, on the McGill Science Faculty mini website. You can go there and look at all the previous questions. I'd also like to remind you to please fill out the evaluation forms. And this time you get to do two. You get to do the evaluation for tonight, and you get to do an overall evaluation. Now, there is no specific question, but there's a blank space at the end where we'd like to solicit your ideas of topics for other mini-science series. We've not decided yet on what the topic will be for next year, so we are open to suggestions. Obviously, they have to be somehow in the scientific realm, so that if you can give us some ideas for that, we would certainly appreciate it. Once you've filled out the questions, there'll be volunteers at the back who will take them. Because this is the last in our series, we'd like to thank all the technicians who helped, the video technicians. We'd like to thank all of the volunteers who have helped with this. And I just would like to bring one more notion to your attention, is that today is kind of a big day for us at the office, because we have revamped our website. And we are relaunching our website, and if you want to note that, this is the new URL. I think you will enjoy it. And of course, as everyone else must be, we are now also on Facebook, and we are on Twitter. And we thank Emily here for doing all of that and keeping us in the forefront of the electronic age, so that now we can come to you through every possible electronic fashion. So we'll give you a few minutes to complete the evaluations and hopefully get your suggestions for other mini science. And thank you very much for your attention, and we will see you next year.